From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the Bush administration's record on the environment. First, we talk with Robert Kennedy Jr. He's an environmental lawyer who's the senior counsel for the Natural Resources Defense Fund. Kennedy says President Bush is set to dismantle 30 years of environmental legislation and will go down as the worst environmental president in history. Then we'll hear from Charlie Kuhn, senior policy analyst for energy and the environment at the Heritage Foundation. Kuhn supports many of the president's environmental policies and says he's doing the right thing by trying to balance energy, the economy, and the environment. The Bush administration and the environment, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush is lifting the tariffs he imposed on some foreign steel products 20 months ago. White House spokesman Scott McClellan read a statement in which the president promised to keep an eye on the steel trade.
We will continue our steel import licensing and monitoring program so that my administration can quickly respond to future import surges that could unfairly damage the industry.
American steelworkers say President Bush's decision will set back the recovery efforts of U.S. steelmakers and could lead to more job cuts, NPR's David Shaper reports.
Steelworkers agree with the president that the tariffs were working, keeping foreign competitors from flooding the U.S. market with an excess of cheap steel, while U.S. steelmakers had begun to consolidate and restructure to be better able to compete. United Steelworkers staff rep Bill Carey in Gary, Indiana, says the 25,000 steel industry jobs in Northwest Indiana had become a bit more secure. But Carey says the recovery isn't complete yet, and he predicts dire consequences if the market is again flooded with cheap imported steel.
You'll see the industry getting weaker, and you'll probably see more companies go bankrupt and more people lose their jobs. More people lose their health insurance. More retirees lose their health insurance.
Carey and other steelworkers call the safeguards the Bush administration says it will implement to limit imports of steel little more than window dressing. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago.
A federal attorney has been found murdered after failing to show up to prosecute a drug case in Baltimore. The body of Jonathan Luna was found in Pennsylvania, about 55 miles northeast of the city. Luna was trying the case of a Baltimore rap musician named Dion Smith and one of his former associates. The two men are accused of selling heroin from their recording studio, Stash House Records. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld was in Afghanistan today, where he met with two rival warlords who say they've begun to disarm and talked with the head of the NATO-led peacekeepers. NPR's Emily Harris reports from Kabul.
Rumsfeld said freedom and opportunity are taking root in Afghanistan. Local leaders are in the middle of choosing delegates to finalize a new constitution at a Loya Jirga meeting next week. Voter registration is beginning for presidential elections, scheduled for next June. Both Rumsfeld and President Karzai played down continuing attacks in Afghanistan. Rumsfeld said there may always be incidents from time to time. Karzai said things are improving. Today, a convoy of government workers collecting information for a UN-sponsored census was attacked in western Afghanistan. One man was killed and five seriously injured. Just after Rumsfeld left Kabul, an explosion happened within several hundred yards of the U.S. embassy. A spokesperson says there was no damage. Emily Harris, NPR News, Kabul.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 57 points to close at 9,930 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq was up 8 points to close at 1968. This is NPR News. Two former top executives of a Kansas-based utility company have been indicted by a grand jury. The 40-count indictment accuses David Wittig, the former CEO of Westar Energy, and former Vice President Douglas Lake, with looting millions from the company. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
Acting Deputy Attorney General James Comey accused the pair of treating Westar, the largest electric company in the state of Kansas, like their own personal piggy bank. Comey outlined a scheme where Wittig allegedly charged the company more than $800,000 to move out of a New York condo he never left. And he says the pair also face a host of other charges.
The indictment alleges that through theft, fraud, and outright intimidation, Wittig and Lake concocted a scheme to loot the company of tens of millions of dollars.
Federal officials say they will seek the return of more than $30 million from the two men. In the case of Wittig, already convicted and awaiting sentencing in a bank fraud case, the government says it will seek forfeiture of a mansion, several million dollars worth of art, and a 2001 Ferrari. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
A judge in Grand Forks, North Dakota, has set bail of $5 million for a convicted rapist who's accused in connection with the disappearance of a 22-year-old college student almost 2 weeks ago. A lawyer for Alfonso Rodriguez said his client wanted to remain in jail for his own safety. Some North Dakotans are questioning why Rodriguez was released from prison after serving 23 years for attempted kidnapping. Meanwhile, law enforcement officials are still searching for Drew Shodine, who vanished from a mall parking lot in Grand Forks on November 22nd. Police say she was last heard from talking on her cell phone to her boyfriend when the call was interrupted. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we're going to talk about the Bush administration and its environmental record, a subject about which there is great division in America, as you'll hear from our two guests. In an article in this month's edition of Rolling Stone, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. says that the Bush administration is rolling back America's environmental laws and weakening the protection of our country's air, water, public lands, and wildlife, but has hidden its anti-environmental program behind deceptive rhetoric. We'll hear from Kennedy in a moment. Later, we'll talk with Charlie Kuhn, the senior policy analyst for energy and the environment at the conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation. She says that the president is doing the right thing by trying to balance energy, the economy, and the environment. My first guest, Robert Kennedy Jr., is an environmental lawyer and activist. He's the senior attorney for the Natural Resources Defense Council and the president of Waterkeeper Alliance. You said that President Bush will go down in history as America's worst environmental president. We'll get into some of the details of why you've reached that conclusion, but give us the overview of why you say that.
He's the worst environmental president that we've ever had because of his deliberate, concerted efforts to dismantle 30 years of environmental law and his capacity, because he controls the anti-environmentalists now control not only the White House, but both houses of Congress. So his ability, his capacity to actually do it. And if you look at NRDC's website, the Natural Resources Defense Council, you'll see that President Bush currently has over 200 major environmental rollbacks or weakening of environmental laws that are now being promoted by this administration. If even a fraction of these are passed over the upcoming year, we will, by this time next year, have effectively no significant federal environmental laws left in our country. This is not exaggeration. This isn't hyperbole. This is a fact. Many of our laws will remain on the books in one form or the other, but they'll be unenforceable, and we will be like Mexico, which has these wonderful, even poetic environmental laws, but nobody knows about them, and nobody complies with them.
You've said that the environmental laws will be unenforceable. What will make them unenforceable if the Bush administration plans go through?
Well, the laws are being chipped away within the agencies to redefine them, to narrow their scopes dramatically. For example, the Clean Water Act, under a new Bush proposal, would only protect navigable waters. The Clean Water Act now forbids the discharge of pollution into any waterway in the United States, whether it's a small stream or a wetland or Lake Erie. But the Bush administration wants to change that definition so that it will only protect waterways that are actually, in fact, navigable. This will exclude up to half of the waters and stream miles in our country. Another proposal the Bush administration has already passed and is already doing tremendous damage to waterways across the country is it's rewritten the Clean Water Act so that it will no longer protect waterways against the discharges of solid waste. This includes mining waste, rubble from construction debris, garbage. A year ago, if you wanted to discharge those things into waters of the United States, you would have had to get a permit. Under the current administration interpretation, a Clean Water Act permit is no longer required. But the most damaging part of these, the kind of neutron bomb of these proposals, are a series of super mandates, what are known as super mandates, which are small laws that seem innocuous, that can actually eviscerate all of our environmental laws at once. One of these that has been promoted by the Bush administration is the Property Rights Protection Act, or the Takings Bill, which they're trying to attach to some of these must-pass budget bills. And what that bill says is that government can't enforce or pass a legislation that diminishes somebody's property values unless it first goes and pays the property owner the cost of complying with the law. Now, if government had to pay people not to do bad things on their property, government would simply cease to exist. You could not print enough money. If you had to pay people not to dump solid waste, or not to dump sewage into waterways from their property, or not to put toxics into the air, or not to kill endangered species, or fill wetlands. Even if in filling that wetland, they're going to destroy a community water supply, they're going to cause floods in the local community, they're going to destroy local populations of fishes and birds that other members of the community rely on, we would have to pay you not to do that in order to enforce the law. So, of course, none of these laws would ever be enforced again. And it's ridiculous because every law diminishes somebody's property values.
One of the things you do is prosecute polluters. You're an environmental lawyer. Is your job prosecuting polluters becoming more difficult?
It is, because the laws themselves are being undermined. And I'll give you a couple of examples. 12 years ago, I brought a lawsuit against the utility, big power plants, for killing fish, against the industry itself for killing fish. I actually sued EPA for failing to pass regulations that regulate fish kills at power plants. Some power plants, these antiquated power plants that use once-through cooling to cool their steam coils, suck in billions of gallons of water. For example, on the Hudson River, the Indian Point power plant uses 1 million gallons a minute. Well, all the fish that are in the river also get sucked in and killed. On the Delaware River, there's a one power plant, the Salem Nuclear Power Plant, that kills, according to its own consultant, Martin Marietta, 175 billion with a B bay anchovies every year, and 155 billion with a B weak fish every year. And the Martin Marietta, although it was required to assess all the impacts on all the fisheries, stopped counting after it counted those fish kills, and said that if this plant begins operating, it will collapse all the fisheries of the Delaware River. And in fact, as soon as the plant began operating, all those fisheries did collapse. Altogether on the East Coast, about 1 trillion fish a year are killed by the industry. It's illegal. The EPA has an obligation under the Clean Water Act to promulgate regulations that require the industry to use the best available technology for eliminating these fish kills. That technology is cooling towers. It's expensive. The utilities don't like it, so they've been able to block those regulations for 20 years. I sued them. We sued them 12 years ago, and last year we finally got a decision from the federal judge. We won the case, and the EPA was ordered to promulgate regulations. The Bush administration immediately came in and promulgated phony regulations that say best available technology essentially is whatever technology you're currently using, and just redefined the term best available technology. So now we're going to have to sue the Bush administration, and the likelihood is we'll win that suit, but it may take another 8 or 10 years, and in the meantime, global fisheries are collapsing, and this is one of the primary causes.
The Bush administration has a new proposal on regulating mercury emissions. Before we get to the proposal, can you just describe what the hazards are of mercury emissions?
Mercury is a potent neurotoxin. It causes a whole inventory of grim illnesses, including permanent IQ loss in children, renal damage, liver damage, and mutations, destruction to brain tissue and nervous tissue. Mercury is now ubiquitous in many of our fishes. For example, I live 2 miles from the state of Connecticut. It is now unsafe to eat any freshwater fish in the state of Connecticut because of mercury, with one exception, which is hatchery bred trout. I've worked on protecting the New York City water supply for almost 20 years, and New York's water comes from these upstate reservoirs that have been protected from industrial pollution for over 100 years. A few months ago, we found that the fish in them are unsafe to eat for mercury. There's no geological source of mercury in the state of Connecticut or in the New York City water supply, but that mercury is coming from air precipitation. And the primary source for those emissions in our country are coal-burning power plants, mainly in the Ohio Valley. About 40%, 40 to 50% of the mercury emissions in our countries come from coal, from these antiquated dinosaur coal-burning power plants that the Bush administration has recently given permission to continue discharging mercury forever.
Can you briefly explain the Bush administration's proposal to deal with mercury emissions and why you oppose it?
Yeah, under the Clean Water Act and under the Clean Air Act, the mercury emissions from these power plants are illegal. When Congress first passed the Clean Air Act, it recognized that there is no right to pollute our air. But the utility industry came in and said, wait a minute, we've made large investments in old plants and these big coal plants that cannot comply with the new standards in the Clean Air Act. We're going to oppose the Clean Air Act. The compromise that was worked out was that those plants would be allowed to operate until they made major changes in their operations. That happened over the last 10 years. Most of them have made those major changes, but most of them, or many of them, did not upgrade as they were supposed to do under the Clean Air Act. So the Clinton administration Justice Department began suing them and prosecuting them because what they were doing was in many cases, a criminal activity. The Bush administration came in, dropped all of those lawsuits, and then changed the law so that they'll never have to comply with the new source performance standards. They can continue discharging and polluting at the same levels forever and even increase that pollution without being prosecuted or without violating the law.
My guest is Robert F. Kennedy, Jr. He's the attorney for the Natural Resources Defense Council and president of Waterkeeper Alliance. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Robert Kennedy, Jr. He's an environmental lawyer and activist. He's the senior attorney for the Natural Resources Defense Council and president of Waterkeeper Alliance. You've said that the Bush administration has already done a lot to turn back environmental regulations, and he's been able to do that without having to go through Congress. However, there is a bill going through Congress. It didn't make it this year, but it will probably come back in some form in January, and that's the energy bill. I know you oppose this energy bill. What is your biggest problem with the energy bill?
Well, the energy bill does nothing to address the principal problem of our nation, which is dependence on fossil fuels and foreign oil. The energy bill instead is a $145 billion boondoggle to big oil, big coal, and the nuclear industry. The principal winners are those industries and the princes of Saudi Arabia. The big losers are the American people. The energy bill was hatched in 106 days of closed-door meetings between Vice President Cheney's Energy Task Force, which was composed of government officials all with energy industry pedigrees, and energy industry lobbyists. There's virtually nothing in the bill for conservation. The bill would exempt the oil industry, for example, from any liability for putting MTBE in our nation's water supplies. There are 2,000 towns and cities across the country that now have found that their water supplies are contaminated with MTBE, which was an additive that was put 20 years ago into our fuel by the oil companies. They claim that, you know, that EPA ordered them to do it, but in fact the record shows that they rammed MTBE down EPA's throat. Now we find that MTBE is cancer-causing, it flows easily through groundwater, and it's contaminated all of these drinking water wells. And the well owners in the towns and the cities across the country are now suing the energy industry for compensation to clean up this mess. What this bill does, which is a $50 billion value to the energy industry, is to simply exempt big oil from having to pay any of these claims and force local taxpayers and local consumers to clean up the mess that the energy that the oil industry made of their water supplies.
There was a movement to remove that MTBE provision from the energy bill. If that was removed, would you be any more enthusiastic about the bill?
No, the bill, there's nothing in that bill that does what we need done for our country and for the American people, which is to give us a more reliable energy supply and to reduce our dependence on oil and coal. That's what we ought to be doing. For example, the best thing that we could do would be corporate average fuel efficiency standards to improve the fuel efficiency of the American automobile. If we raise fuel efficiency standards in our cars by 1 mile per gallon, we get more oil than would be in two Arctic National Wildlife Refuges. If we raise it by 2.7 miles per gallon, we eliminate all of the oil that we import from Iraq and Kuwait combined. If we raise fuel efficiency by 7.6 miles per gallon, we eliminate 100% of our Gulf oil imports into this country. Think of what that could do for America. We would reduce our vulnerability to price shocks on the international oil market. We put money in the pocket of every American. If I had a car that got 40 miles per gallon rather than one that gets 25 miles per gallon, I'd have an extra $1,000 in my pocket every year. And so would every American. And think what that would do for our economy. At one point, President Bush sent us all a $300 check and called that an economic stimulus package. And we had to gut the Social Security Trust Fund in order to do it. And it was just for 1 year. Imagine if all of us were getting an extra $1,000 or $300 or $500 every single year forever. But, you know, $78 million worth of checkbook diplomacy between Detroit and Washington, D.C. over the past 10 years has effectively excluded that. The biggest advocate against fuel efficiency standards in this country over the past 10 years has been Spencer Abrams, and he was one of the authors of the energy bill. So obviously there's nothing in there that's going to do what we really need to be done to benefit America and our people.
One part of the energy bill that environmentalists successfully got removed was the part that would have allowed the drilling of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. How significant is it to you that that is no longer allowed within the bill?
It doesn't make the bill any better. It's like, you know, putting lipstick on a donkey. The bill is bad, you know, if you ask the administration officials, is there anything good in here for the environment, they say, well, you know, we got rid of the Arctic drilling provision. But the entire bill is a catastrophe for the American people. It's a huge boom for big oil, which incidentally is making record profits. The day that Cheney announced the Energy Task Force report, Exxon announced that it had tripled profits from the previous year. The energy industry has quintupled profits since 1999. So while many Americans were struggling through a recession, the energy industry was the one industry that was profiting both from the president's foreign policy and from his domestic policy.
You know, there are advocates of drilling of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge who say if you want a reliable energy future, you've got to start drilling there, and that will make us less dependent on foreign oil.
Well, that's nonsense. The Arctic National Wildlife Refuge contains less than 0.2% of global reserves. Oil is an international commodity. The oil from the Arctic, most of it doesn't even come to our country. It's shipped to Europe. and it was being drilled by BP, which isn't even an American oil company. And it's very expensive oil. And even if you got all of the oil out of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, it would not reduce the price of oil at our pumps by even a penny per gallon. Our problem is we have trivial amounts of oil in this country now. We have about 2% of global reserves in our country. So even if we extract all of it and destroy our sacred places in the process, it's not going to, we cannot drill our way out of oil dependence. We have much cheaper sources of energy in this country and much more efficient sources of energy in this country, beginning with conservation. But we ought to be looking at renewables, and we ought to be exercising leadership to make the switch over the next 10 years to a hydrogen fuel economy. And that's the kind of leadership that we need from the White House.
President Bush does have a proposal to increase the development and use of hydrogen fuel and the development of hydrogen-fueled cars.
Well, yeah, he announced that proposal in a State of the Union address, and it's been labeled or heralded as, you know, as an act of environmental leadership. But the devil is in the details. And if you look at the details of that proposal, it's a joke. First of all, it's a trivial amount of money. We give about $55 billion a year in direct subsidies to the oil companies. And this proposal is for, I think, $1.4 billion. But that aside, the thing that environmentalists like about hydrogen is that hydrogen can be extracted from water, and its byproducts when you burn it are oxygen and water. There's no pollution that comes from your pipe, and so you could create a hydrogen economy without creating huge amounts of pollution from fossil fuels. But the president took his $1.4 billion and gave it to the automobile industry to figure out ways to extract hydrogen, not from water, but from oil and coal, which puts the same global warming gases and the same pollutants into our air. So it's really kind of a bait and switch. It's kind of a perverse use of the environmental mantle to shield something that is just going to benefit the oil and coal industry and the automobile industry.
Robert Kennedy Jr. is the senior attorney for the Natural Resources Defense Council and the president of Waterkeeper Alliance. More on the Bush administration and the environment in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of Joel Meyerowitz's new volume of photography, Tuscany, Inside the Light, with text by Maggie Barrett, available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. From Koch Entertainment, featuring Joan Baez's Dark Chords on a Big Guitar, including Christmas in Washington by Steve Earle, along with songs by Ryan Adams and Gillian Welch, available now at all Barnes & Noble music locations and online at bn.com. And by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a financial services company serving nearly 3 million members. Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, where values thrive. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on the Bush administration and the environment. We continue our conversation with environmental lawyer Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and we hear from Charlie Kuhn, senior policy analyst for energy and the environment at the Heritage Foundation. She praises the president for balancing the environment, energy, and the economy.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking about the Bush administration and the environment. Let's get back to our interview with Robert F. Kennedy Jr., an environmental lawyer and activist. He's the senior attorney for the Natural Resources Defense Council and the president of Waterkeeper Alliance. One of your criticisms of the Bush administration when it comes to energy is you say the administration cloaks its environmental policies in language designed to deceive the public. What's an example of that?
Well, everybody knows about the Healthy Forests Act, which is an act that actually allows kind of industrial 1950s-style industrial forestry on our protected lands that were formerly protected from cutting. The Clear Skies Initiative, which is really a way of adding more pollution to our water, which will make our skies dirtier. Environmentalists call it the Clear Lies Initiative. The administration, under the coaching of its pollster, Frank Luntz, has been told that they should use words like streamlining regulations rather than weakening regulations. The reason for this is a stealth attack, and the reason for it is that, and Frank Luntz has said this himself in a secret memo to the Bush administration that was obtained by NRDC, that the American public is against the president when it comes to these environmental rollbacks. They do not want our laws weakened. They want strict enforcement of our environmental laws. And this is true across the board, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. And Luntz warned the administration that if they're going to roll back our environmental laws, they have to do it secretly. And they have to cloak their anti-environmental agenda in the mantle of environmentalism. And that's what the administration has done. And it's been very, very successful at this. Many of the rollbacks have occurred, the most damaging ones, behind the scenes in the dark corridors of the White House, in the Office of Management Budget, under the leadership of John Graham, who has essentially transformed the agencies like EPA and the Department of Interior and the Department of Agriculture that are supposed to be protecting America's interest in our valuable resources, and has transformed those agencies into arms of the industries that they are meant to regulate. They are now captured agencies. The head of the Forestry Department is a former timber industry lobbyist. The head of public lands is a coal and mining industry lobbyist. And the national policies now reflect the agendas of those industries rather than the interests of the American public.
You have six children. Three of them have asthma. How does that connect to your environmental activism?
Well, you know, we are suffering as a nation an asthma epidemic now. One out of every four black children in New York City has asthma. We don't know why this pandemic is happening, but we do know that the asthma attacks themselves are triggered by bad air days, particularly by particulates and ozone in the air. The primary source of particulates and ozone are Midwestern power plants that are operating illegally under the Clean Air Act. The Bush administration was, and I can watch my children gasping for air on bad air days. And, you know, I'm thinking to myself, we are living in a science fiction nightmare right now where we are literally bringing children into the world where the air is too poisonous for them to breathe because somebody made a contribution to the Bush administration, because the industry gave $48 million to the Republican Party and to the Bush campaign during the 2000 campaign. And as a result of that, the industry itself has gotten billions of dollars in relief by not having to comply with the new source performance standards in the Clean Air Act that would have forced them to reduce the amounts of particulates and ozone that they're discharging into our air. I live 3 hours south of the Adirondack Mountains. That's the oldest protected wilderness on Earth. It's been protected since 1888. And yet half the lakes in the Adirondacks are now sterilized. And the reason for that is acid rain from those same power plants, which has destroyed the forest cover on the high peaks of the Appalachians from Georgia all the way up into Canada. So these power plants are imposing huge costs on the American public that they should have to pay. In a true free market economy, they would have to pay those costs themselves. And that is the purpose of our federal environmental laws to reimpose the free market economy. But what the Bush administration has done is allowed itself to be bought off by this industry so that they are now imposing these costs where my children can no longer breathe on bad air days. They're gasping for breath. That they can't enjoy the seminal, primal experience of American youth, which is to go fishing with their father and eating the fish. And they can't go camping in the Adirondacks and enjoy the forests that have been protected since 1888 in those conditions.
You know, you've mentioned that three of your children have asthma. They were, of course, you know, born before George Bush became the president. So anything he's done is not directly responsible for the asthma that they have. But I'm wondering if say things were continued to head in the direction that President Clinton had been moving in environmentally, do you think that we would have been in much different shape than we are now environmentally?
Well, first of all, to answer your first question, we don't know why we're having an epidemic of asthma. Nobody knows what the causes are. You know, there's all kinds of explanations for it, but I can tell you in the last 5 years, the incident of asthma has doubled in 5 years among American children. We don't know why that is. There's plenty of suspicion that it comes from pesticides or hormones that are now ubiquitous in our food supply, but nobody really knows. What we do know is that asthma attacks are caused by bad air days, by ozone and particulates in particular. And those materials in our air have been increased, not decreased, by the Bush administration. Under the Clinton plan, those materials would gradually disappear. And in a short time, they would be, the incidence of those materials in our air would dramatically diminish. But under the Bush administration plan, which has already been implemented, those materials will remain in our air forever and even increase.
So much of America's attention has been focused on terrorism and the war in Iraq. How do you think that terrorism and the war has affected the amount of energy that the Bush administration is spending on environmental issues, and how much do you think that the attention to terrorism and the war is affecting public awareness of what's being done?
If you think back to August of 2001, President Bush had his back against the wall on environmental issues. He had tried to pass regulations that allowed arsenic in drinking water. He had abandoned the Kyoto Protocol. He had abandoned his own promises about limiting carbon dioxide. And the press and the public were furious, and the administration was feeling the political pain of them. All of that disappeared after September 11th. The environmental reporters and newspapers across the country were reassigned to cover terrorism and the war in Iraq, and the public attention was diverted. And, you know, when I go around, Terry, I go around the country and talk to people about these environmental rollbacks, and the initial reaction inevitably is, oh, you know, how could President Bush be doing this? How could this be true? We don't believe you. He hasn't had time to do this. And the fact is that the relentless attack on the environment, the assault on the environment, continued during the war in Iraq, but coverage of it ceased almost completely. And it's allowed the president and his cronies in the energy industry to dismantle our environmental laws without any public debate, without any public scrutiny or public complaint. Plus, you have a press that is very, very reluctant to criticize the president in a time of war, and a press that is not paying attention to these critical issues.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Robert Kennedy Jr. is the senior attorney for the Natural Resources Defense Council and the president of Waterkeeper Alliance. Coming up, we talk about the Bush administration and the environment with Charlie Kuhn, senior policy analyst for energy and the environment at the Heritage Foundation. This is Fresh Air.
We'll be right back.
We're talking about the Bush administration and the environment. My guest Charlie Kuhn says that many environmentalists, like our previous guest, Robert Kennedy Jr., are alarmists. She admires President Bush for balancing the environment, energy, and the economy. Kuhn is senior policy analyst for energy and the environment at the think tank The Heritage Foundation. How would you rate President Bush's environmental record?
Well, I think that he probably would get, if we were using the alphabet, perhaps maybe a B, C plus. I think that what he's trying to do is to bring balance to the arena and to look at the three critical E's, and that is the energy, the environment, and the economy. All three are related, and they interact with each other. And in making policy for one, you have to consider the consequences, whether they be intended or unintended consequences, to the other. And I think that he is trying to bring a balanced, common sense approach to the foreground.
What do you think have been the Bush administration's greatest environmental accomplishments?
This week, for example, the president signed the Healthy Forest Initiative. And as Congressman or Chairman Pombo has said, this is probably the greatest environmental protection legislation that we've seen since the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act. And he was able to get that through both a House and the Senate. And I think that is a positive step. I also think that the president's original energy plan is a balanced, diverse plan. I'm not talking about the legislation that the House and the Senate recently reconciled, but his original energy plan had a diversity of fuel resources and was a balanced plan.
The Healthy Forests Initiative has been criticized by environmentalists for actually making it easier to deforest the forests. It's easier to hurt the forests as opposed to making it easier to protect the forests.
Well, the forests right now are unnaturally dense, diseased, and insect infested. I imagine that what they're trying to say is that they would rather see catastrophic fires that will sterilize the soil, that will destroy wildlife habitat and wetlands and watersheds, instead of using common sense management for our forests. The forests are no different than any other kind of quote-unquote property. If you do not maintain your house, if you do not maintain your health, if you do not maintain your car, then eventually you're going to have problems.
The Bush administration wants to abandon a plan that was started under the EPA of the Clinton administration that deals with mercury emissions. The Clinton plan proposed that industry be required to install the best available technology to dramatically limit mercury emissions from power plants. The Bush administration wants to abandon that regulation and substitute a new one that would give a lot more flexibility to the industry. There'd be more mercury emissions under the Bush administration rules than under the Clinton administration ones. What's your reaction to the Bush proposed regulation?
Well, first of all, I don't believe that it's accurate to say that the Bush administration is abandoning the regulation of mercury. Certainly it is proposing to regulate mercury, but doing it in a different and more flexible approach that will sufficiently regulate and reduce mercury emissions, number one. Also, power plants are just a minor source of mercury emissions anyway. So even if you close down all power plants, say coal-fired power plants, there's still going to be considerable mercury in fish. That's where humans usually get the mercury, because it's a natural substance that's in the oceans and in fish, as well as wildfires and volcanoes. So it's not just an issue related to utilities.
Robert Kennedy Jr. says that in Connecticut and New York, there is no other source except power plants for the mercury that's in the fish. Would you speculate as to what other sources might be causing the fish to have mercury in their tissues?
Well, again, I think the issue there is not so much that is there mercury there or not, but what is the amount that is harmful? The University of Rochester and the National Institute of Health has conducted a study and is still conducting a study, and recently a pediatric neurologist testified at a hearing on the Hill and said, we do not believe that there is presently good scientific evidence that moderate fish consumption is harmful to the fetus. Now, that study is also based on people eating 10 times what the normal individual eats in fish. So the evidence, there's not all the scientific support out there that the alarmists would have people believe.
What is your overall view of the energy bill? It didn't get through Congress this year, but it's likely to be introduced again in January, perhaps in a slightly different form.
The energy bill is a missed opportunity, regrettably. Unfortunately, the energy bill is just laden with pork and does not go far enough in enhancing the nation's domestic energy supplies. And the Energy Information Administration, which is an independent statistical and analytical agency at the Department of Energy, has consistently said and predicted that our consumption is going to exceed our production over the next 20 years. If we're going to have an energy bill, the purpose of an energy bill should be to provide abundant and reliable and affordable energy supplies. This bill does not significantly correct the imbalance.
What measures would you recommend?
Particularly with natural gas, that we open up the offshore areas and the outer continental shelf. Now, Congress has been for years, through their different policies, advancing and encouraging the use of natural gas. And yet, on the other hand, they want people to use natural gas, but they're not providing access to where the natural gas is. I think they need to be consistent in their policies. If they're not going to allow access to natural gas, then they ought not be making policies that encourage the use of natural gas.
What about cutting down dependence on foreign oil? Do you think that that's a practical strategy, something that should be pursued?
Well, certainly. I think that the more independent we are on any of our fuel sources, the better off we are. However, having said that, we're never going to be totally independent on oil, and I don't believe that anyone, certainly in the administration, has been saying that we're going to be able to be totally independent. But I do believe that the Congress made a bad policy decision in not opening up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Only 2,000 acres of a desolate, flat, treeless tundra that has a mean estimate of 10.3 billion barrels of oil, which is considerably more than what we have right now, even in the state of Texas. Again, the issue there is that it is reliable oil, and it's the equivalent of about 35 years worth of oil from Iraq.
What about raising the fuel efficiency standards in cars so that we're saving on oil?
Well, the fuel efficiency for automobiles, of course, we all want fuel efficient automobiles. But the problem with having a federal statutory standard is that it causes the automobiles to be downsized to meet those standards. And as a result of that, even the National Academy of Sciences has said, because of what we call the CAFE standards, because of these standards, automobiles or vehicles have been downsized, and as a result, we have more fatalities. Downsizing automobiles causes deaths. Now, having said that, the automobile industry has been developing and putting out cleaner and better cars each year. The fuel efficient standards don't go to the issue that the alarmists are concerned about. It doesn't apply to every automobile. If they're concerned about something, they should be coming up with some proposals to get rid of the older cars, because each new model of vehicle is better and cleaner than the year before.
You know, you're saying that the smaller cars, the fuel-efficient smaller cars, are actually also unsafe, but, you know, a lot of people would say it's the larger gas-guzzling vehicles, like the SUVs and the Hummers, that both guzzle gas and present real safety hazards, both for the people in those cars and for any smaller cars that they might collide with.
Well, actually, the fatality rate is higher if you have two small cars crashing into each other with a frontal attack, frontal crash. So I guess you can just look at the statistics and spin them the way that you want to. But again, the safest vehicles on the road are the large SUVs. And if someone wants to have a fuel-efficient vehicle, they're available. There's hybrids out there and there's fuel-efficient cars. But if an individual feels that the SUV meets their needs for safety as well as their other needs, whether it be for hauling or for businesses or carting the kids around, going grocery shopping, then they should be entitled and have the right to choose an SUV.
My guest is Charlie Kuhn, Senior Policy Analyst for Energy and the Environment at the Heritage Foundation. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Charlie Kuhn. She's a senior policy analyst for energy and the environment at the Heritage Foundation. Critics of the Bush administration, including Robert Kennedy Jr., who we heard from earlier, say the Bush administration is pushing for 200 major environmental rollbacks in environmental actions, including action pertaining to the Clean Water Act. A Bush administration proposal would mean, if enacted, would mean that the Clean Water Act would only apply to navigable waters and not to streams and other smaller bodies of water that aren't navigable. Are your thoughts on that?
Well, let me start with the second first in terms of the rollbacks. I find it very interesting that whenever this administration wants to make a change, it doesn't matter what it is, a change to an environmental regulation or policy, it is immediately spun as being a rollback, whereas in the prior administration, any change that was made was automatically assumed, incorrectly, I might add, assumed to be an improvement. And I think we're seeing some media bias there and the spin from the left in that regard. In terms of the Clean Water Act or any of the environmental acts, The Bush administration wants to ensure that we have clean water and that we have clean air. Conservatives, I'm a conservative, I drink water, I breathe air, and want it to be clean. I think that the goals are the same, but I think how we get there is what is different, and particularly that conservatives do not believe that you need big brother government command and control measures to actually ensure that we have clean air and clean water.
Are you concerned about the number of people within the Bush administration who have ties to the energy industry, including the president and the vice president?
You know, only in Washington, D.C. would expertise be a liability. As many of your listeners may remember, when we were having the initial election for the president, President Bush was being criticized because he didn't have experience. He didn't know what he was doing. You know, we need somebody that's got foreign policy experience and more domestic policy experience. He wins the election, and you've got two individuals that understand the energy industry. They know what it takes to produce energy. They know what it takes to conserve energy. They know the industry from, you know, top down. And yet now that becomes a liability. Who do you expect the president and vice president to talk to? Brain surgeons for energy policy? Of course you expect them to talk to the energy industry because they are the experts. And I might add that the administration has listened to many different groups, not just the energy industry. Various environmental groups have been invited to discuss the energy and environment legislation and initiatives with the president. The fact that some of them don't want to sit down with the president because they don't want him to have any type of a quote-unquote green win, that is their problem. But the administration has certainly extended its hand to all groups.
In an article published this month in Rolling Stone magazine, Robert Kennedy Jr. writes a few lines about the Heritage Foundation, where you work, and he says that it was founded by the brewer Joseph Coors. He writes, Coors founded the right-wing Heritage Foundation to provide a philosophical underpinning for the anti-environmental movement.
Well, first of all, I think that's just nonsense, and I think that many of our donors would be surprised to know that they are purportedly supporting an anti-environmental movement. The Heritage Foundation is a conservative think tank. Less than 10%, might even be as low as 8 or 5% of our funding comes from corporations. It's individuals that support the Heritage Foundation that support conservative, common sense principles as solutions to the nation's problems.
Charlie Kuhn, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Charlie Kuhn is Senior Policy Analyst for Energy and the Environment at the Heritage Foundation. Earlier, we heard from environmental lawyer and activist Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Sherrock. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the Internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This month marks the 50th anniversary of Playboy magazine. On the next Fresh Air, an interview with its founder, Hugh Hefner. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.